This is Rebecca Lowe, or Rebecca Lua, if you listen to Suboptimal Radio, and you are listening to Men in Blazers on the NBC Sports Network.
It's unbelievable!
Oh, it's going to be a sad night this Sunday when Mad Men comes to a close after 7 epic seasons of television. The serially seductive show ensnared us with Lane Price, then kept us hooked by demonstrating, in the words of John Cheever, that genuinely decorous men and women admit into their affairs erotic bitterness or even greed, a life truth for everyone, even Steve Bruce. We were delighted when the show's creator, Matthew Weiner, dropped into the panic room and seized on the opportunity to mark the show's conclusion by talking to him about the creative process, writing for television, career building, and understanding modern American history. For anyone who writes, reads, makes music, film, art, or origami, listening to Matt offers an insight into the creative process from someone who's mastered it.
The man behind us, an Emmy award-winning writer, producer, and director. What have we been doing with our time, Rog? His show Mad Men has given us a world in which philandering, booze-addled prodigies grapple with their own inner demons while trying to appeal to the masses. That is perfect training for a Premier League scriptwriter, as far as we're concerned.
Sounds very similar to this show, Davey.
The final season of Mad Men is airing right now, 10 p.m. Sundays on AMC. Ladies and gentlemen, Matthew Weiner. Matthew Weiner. I've always struggled with that in America.
It makes me feel more like I'm in a sports world when I hear it said wrong.
Why? Oh, really? Because there's so much mispronunciation in sports. Yes. Well, you've obviously watched us talking about the Premier League.
It reminds me of being in phys ed.
Yes. Oh, in which it was pronounced wrong all
always.
The time.
What
was Matthew
Weiner. What was your phys ed teacher's name?
We had a couple of them, but one of them was Coach Blankenmeyer.
And Coach Blankenmeyer, where are you now? Yeah.
Blankenmeyer?
Blankenmeyer. Hey, Weiner, cut out the grab ass.
Wow. What sport were you playing then?
Oh, we were just... I did wrestling, actually.
Wow.
Lesson one in life, never cut out the grab ass.
Yeah, never do it. Never. That's very, very true.
1996.
Yeah.
You're talking about What You Do All Day.
No, that was a movie.
A movie?
That was a $12,000 a movie. Is this internet related? Is this research?
Yes, it is internet. Yeah. We only read Wikipedia on this show. We're sponsored by them. it was a slow start, would you say? Yeah. A slow start to the burgeoning career that you would never have guessed that you would get from there to here. I read you talk about the Horatio Alger story that underpins America. You said how we laud it. And then we know that it's really all based on failure, insecurity, and an identity modeled on some abstract ideal of white power. Forget white power for one quick second. But is darkness the key to success, would you say, in many cases?
Not succumbing to darkness, I think, is. And, you know, you say it's a slow start. When you go from waiting around for the phone to ring, you know, and being completely powerless over your life, and then... You go out there and, you know, you say, I'm going to do it. I'm going to build my own airplane or whatever. And all these people come out to help you. And all of the bullshit about, you know, making a start, you know, taking a risk and being part of the process. Like, I want to enjoy my process. There was no product. No one was really interested in the movie, but I was a different person.
Number one. Don't cut out the grab ass. Number two, don't succumb to the darkness, David.
My brother is a movie writer, and he spends a lot of time. I'm sorry, Will. You spend a lot of time alone.
Yeah.
No one else around you. Yeah. Just writing.
TV writing's not like that.
It's the room.
There's the room, and I actually dictate my scripts. So I have a writer's assistant, so I rarely write alone at all.
Take dictation.
I get a lot of my ideas when I'm alone, and I write them down on a piece of paper or call myself on the phone. But I dictate the scripts, and I'm a very social person. It's kind of a performance in a weird way. I do a lot of Joan.
But you do.
But apparently, I've been told this by the writers. I put my hand right here and I start talking and I'm Joan.
But Mad Men was not run like a conventional writer's room the way it was used to. Was it more authored?
No.
Was that your experience being a movie writer as well, that it had a more authored sense?
No. No, no. When you're on a TV show, the showrunner is I mean, it's easier for the culture to understand that one person's in charge, but it's a completely collaborative thing. It's too mysterious for people to understand that many people can contribute their lives, that they write lines, that they write scripts, that it's made out of a lot of ideas. But I am, you know, the person who, like, you know, I'm not just the coach, but I'm also, like, you know, I get to shoot the ball into the goal most of the time. I literally am the person who is, like, making decisions on things. But some of your favorite things in the show, some of the best ideas, some of the most exciting moments or saddest moments, they come from other people. And that was my experience on every show I worked on. That's how TV works. Huh. My old joke is that TV writing is for people who hate being alone more than they hate writing.
He's the, he's the player manager, David.
He is the player manager. It is like being a player manager in soccer.
It is.
Something I read about you that I loved is that you start every series before you start the creative process of Mad Men. You read, and I'm now nervous that it's just another Wikipedia fact.
No, might be true.
John Cheever's introduction to his collected stories.
Yes, I read it to the writer's room.
There's an essay. I read an essay every year. It's a Primo Levi one on Yom Kippur. But Don Draper once said, I keep going to a lot of places and ending up somewhere I've already been.
Yeah.
How do you keep reading that essay fresh and not just go back to the last time you read it and the experience of rereading it and rereading it as a ritual?
Well, yourself? Like Primo Levi, he's a great writer and you can find new things every time you read it. And don't forget that it doesn't change, but you do. You know, what's it like to go back and watch a movie from your childhood with your kids? You're just like, wow, The Wizard of Oz. How did I ever go to sleep after I watched this? And my kids are like enjoying it and then they hit a certain age and they don't want to see it. John Cheever, that I actually find there are sometimes, you know, like there are songs that you can get tired of and they don't work for you anymore. They don't make your heart sore.
And then this Tracy
Exactly. Chapman. It does work all the time. and that introduction is really about he's remembering another time. He has a great line in there too. He's like where you can he talks about the city and stuff like that. That's the part that sort of the writers latch onto. The part I latch onto is he's talking about his collected stories. And he's apologizing for the fact that he became a better writer as they went on. And he sort of said, you can see like a writer taking his first steps, falling. It's like watching someone like learn how to walk. And you know, when you want to hear a great writer that you admire talk about, admit that that it was hard, you know, and that it didn't just, they weren't great all the time.
It's interesting. We're of similar age. And it occurs to me that the world of Don Draper, the 50s, the 60s, ultimately the 70s, but it was sort of like it was recent history when we were growing up and became sort of our early part of our childhood. Yeah. Were you always fascinated with that time period?
You know, I don't. I guess I was a little bit because my parents got married. My parents are Pete Campbell and Trudy's age, so I think that they were kind of stuck in it in some way. And there's a lot of good things about that generation. They're very aspirational. They were the first, you know, in their families to go to college. Mm-hmm. And there was a kind of, they're super liberal. They, like, are not racist anyway. Mm-hmm. They believe in helping out the poor. They have, you know, a lot of really good politics about the fact that America's going to be a better place than every place else.
Yeah.
Along with that were their values, you know, like Hemingway is one of their values. And, like, the Blacklist, you know, is one of the things that they paid attention to. And movies from that period that are sort of more realistic. Like, you know, I wasn't raised in a lot of sword and sorcery. Yeah. It was more about, like, Marty and, like, my dad's a huge movie buff, you know. So I kind of was interested in it. And then, you know, what happened is I started seeing the movies, and it was kind of, since we are the same age, in the 80s, at least in California, the 50s had a huge impact. And we look to that period. I mean, there is no one more.
Greece.
How about Elvis Costello?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? That is like, you know, there's rockabilly.
He was a rockabilly, yeah.
Yeah, there's a, you know, he's got those Buddy Holly glasses. Yeah. That was our definition of cool.
But there's something that you did with it in that post-war era.
I did the uncool people.
Well, not just that, but the old people that you're looking at, you realize, and you've said this, a quote of yours, they said, they may have been more carnal than we are, drunker, less responsible, more violent. And when I read that, I thought, sorry, Tom Brokaw, because I know you watch this show. Yeah. That's what makes him truly the great generation.
The greatest
generation.
The greatest generation.
I mean, that's what you honed in on, though. You took that stuff, what Cheever talks about, the Benny Goodman listeners and the wearing the hat. But you made them real. You made them darker than we are in many
They're hardcore. And the people came out of World War II and they lived through that. And then they had to go back and like function in real life and not pretend like they hadn't like, you know, either been in a prison camp or like killed some German with their bare hands, you know. That's, you know, they lived the dream.
They did live the dream.
No, but they were, and they had no one to talk to. Their psychiatry was really popular in the United States, but not with men. Men didn't do that unless they were, you know, unless they were forced to. So I sort of saw that as like, you know, and so the people who were in charge when we were growing up were the children, were the Sally Draper age people.
Yeah.
And they had this thing about the late 60s and the tumultuous decade, and they're very spoiled. Most of them did not have to go to war. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be really hard on them here for a second just because I identify them with the people who brought in Reaganism. Huh. They also brought in Clintonism, I guess, eventually, but which I liked a lot better. But they really were constantly talking about how they, you know, I'm growing up, going to college, you know, at the height of the AIDS scare, like it's not hard enough for a freshman to get laid to begin with. And they're sitting there reminiscing about, you know, oh, my God, it was just it's constant hot and cold running sex and drugs, and you guys missed out on it. And we were so individualistic and so radical, and we had so many ideals. And I'm like, you are, you know, cut from that to like Oliver Stone's Wall Street. That's who they were. So I wanted to talk about that generation beforehand that kind of looked at them as their children, and maybe they missed out on it, but they were from the Great Depression and World War II, and they were not impressed.
Huh. You also write, you know, obviously the series predominantly set in New York.
Yeah,
and the
I love New York.
New York City and the suburbs.
I love New York, like a lot of people who are not from here.
Yeah,
and Don's not from here, and New York loves people that aren't from here. It's very welcoming, as you know, right? It's pretty amazing.
It's very true. And yeah, one of my favorite.
What would it be
things...
like if we were if I went to London?
Yeah,
I'd be like that American guy.
Yeah, well, yeah, definitely.
We'd be full of even more self-loathing in London.
It's without a doubt. But I love the writing about California because it was it was the early days of the business.
Yeah.
It's sort of as, you know, the wholesale, quite apart from the advertising business, the wholesale TV business and movie business moved out there as well.
Oh, in 1960, when the show starts, nothing is in California.
Yeah.
And it is a demotion or failure, like going to, like going to, you know, whatever, to East whatever.
Yeah.
To go to Los
when
Angeles
Pete
to be
to
in advertising.
There.
Oh, yeah. It's really like, you're not in advertising anymore. Yeah. You're basically in an arm. You're at the... You know, you're out in the country.
The Financial Times, they asked you what the secret to your success is. You said, kiss ass. You know that expression.
Well, he had lunch with the FT. He had lunch with the FT. It's what we aspire to.
You're going
to
need it if you're in show business. You said, I've kissed a lot of ass. That's why I'm here. I did want to ask you what treatment you use on your lips to prevent chapping. The last question I've got for you, in reality, for our young audience... Your English teacher wants
to be respectful to people. That's what I mean about kissing ass. Don't go in and think you can do their job. Do not act entitled. It takes a long time to learn how to do it. And even though they're making it look easy, you don't know how to do it.
That's the greatest euphemism for kissing ass I've ever heard.
I mean it.
I love it.
Be respectful.
Your English teacher once wrote in your yearbook this piece of wisdom: keep doing what you're doing and stick to poetry and starve. You didn't do that. What advice would you now write to young you?
Oh, God. Everything's going to be okay? I mean, what do I... That's the only thing that I know, and I would never have believed it. You couldn't go back and believe it. There was something about, like... I stick to your guns. If people won't give you an opportunity, make an opportunity. Don't make excuses. I got a lot of advice. You know, right? These are the things that stop you from doing stuff.
It's so reassuring to be with David.
It's true.
So, one of the reasons you're one of my heroes,
part, but what man, I said was true.
One of the reasons you're one of my heroes is as a producer.
Yeah.
As a fellow producer, very different kinds of producing, but fellow producer, you've managed to protect your shows from all the people that try to harm them, including, by the way, ourselves and one own teams and one own actors and everybody. But, you know, and I sort of feel, you notice there are no network executives here today at our show, but that's partly because we're shooting in a closet and no one wants to come here. How have you been able to protect? Because Mad Men does not look like a show to me that suffered from a lot of notes or conventions or rules. It feels like you've really written with your team, that you've written something and guided it yourself. How have you managed to do that?
You know what? First of all, I started with people that they had that attitude that they were going to leave me alone.
Mm-hmm.
and they weren't going to pay me that much. And if I was willing to do that, we would do something interesting together as long as I brought everything in on budget. Mm-hmm. And then it started to change. And all I did was keep reminding them of that. And I was kept reminding them that what they had promised me. And at a certain point, I just said, like, the stakes are so low for me. Like, you know, I didn't dare them to fire me, but I basically said, like, they would often, the most contentious conversations would happen when I was like writing the fifth episode and about to start shooting the first episode and had to do the entire season. And they would come and start, you know, just picking everything apart and talking about, they never talked that much about research.
Focus groups.
No, they didn't do that much of that. They did. They were really good about that because, you know, it was such a small thing in a weird way. But I would always say, like, you picked the right day. I'll go home. I was not kidding.
Amazing,
you picked the right day. And you have to mean it. You have to mean it.
The thing about this, man, is that most people who wear the bracelet, WWJCD, what would Jesus Christ do? He wears one, but it's what would John Cheever do?
That's so good.
That's how he lives his life.
What would John Cheever do? He would do that as a bumper sticker.
He would get drunk and go sleep in his car. I never did that.
And that, children of America, is how to live your life.